Bonsoir, soyez les bienvenus à ce podium sur la musique du film. Herzlich willkommen heute Abend zu diesem Schwerpunkttag und jetzt Podium zur Filmmusik. Ich freue mich sehr, dass ihr so zahlreich erschienen seid. Tout d'abord, il y a une traduction simultanée et il y a des écouteurs ici derrière. Für alle, die eine Simultanübersetzung brauchen, gibt es hier hinten Kopfhörer, das könnt ihr einstellen. Und hier heute haben wir speziell, we're going to have a translation also into and from English. So for all translations needed in either all of the three languages, if you don't understand one of the languages, you can just get a headset in the back and you'll have a translation. Ich freue mich sehr, dass wir zum ersten Mal einen Filmmusiktag während diesen Solothurner Filmtagen präsentieren durften. Es ist so ein typisches Beispiel eigentlich dafür, wie wir hier in Solothurn arbeiten. Wir versuchen, nicht nur die Leute ins Rampenlicht zu rücken, die sonst immer im Rampenlicht stehen, sondern auch eben die Leute hinter der Kulisse des Schweizer Films, hinter die arbeiten und die ihre Leidenschaft einbringen. Und ich freue mich sehr, dass da bald und die Smekka mit Lisandra auf uns zugekommen sind, die Solothurner Filmtage. Und am Anfang haben wir einfach gedacht, ja, wollen wir was machen? Wir haben alle gefunden, ja, weshalb nicht? Und dann ist das immer ein bisschen mehr gewachsen. Und am Schluss wurde das ein Filmmusiktag, den wir hier heute gemeinsam durchlaufen, von morgens früh bis abends spät. Ich glaube, es endet dann in einer Party mit Film-DJs. Ich freue mich sehr, dass ich jetzt das Wort den Fachspezialisten übergeben darf, besser gesagt der Fachspezialistin, Theresa Bayer. Theresa Bayer wird heute Abend durch den Abend führen. Sie ist Journalistin beim SRF 2 Kultur und Mitorganisatorin des Norient Festivals. Herzlich willkommen.
Dankeschön. Merci vielmals. Danke, Serena Rohrer, für diese Begrüßung. Ich freue mich sehr jetzt hier auf die Diskussion. 1843 hat die britische Mathematikerin Ada Lovelace in die Zukunft geblickt. Und sie war davon überzeugt, dass eines Tages eine Maschine komplexe Musikstücke komponieren können wird. Ja, und diese Zukunft, in der sind wir jetzt, also willkommen in der Zukunft. Und wir wollen jetzt in den nächsten anderthalb Stunden, also ungefähr so bis 19.30 Uhr, wollen wir ausloten, passt natürlich in dem Zusammenhang auch, wollen wir ausloten, was ist künstliche Intelligenz, was bedeutet das fürs Komponieren allgemein, aber was bedeutet das auch für die Filmkomposition, ist da Potenzial, kann man wirklich von einer Revolution in der Musik sprechen oder ist das einfach ein Tool, mit dem man was sozusagen die Komposition erleichtert oder ist das vielleicht alles vollkommen überbewertet? Eine kleine Einführung ins Thema gibt jetzt Nathan Evans. Der wird jetzt ungefähr 15 Minuten einen Vortrag halten, um Sie sozusagen auf den aktuellen Stand der Technologie zu bringen. Nathan, where are you? Welcome. Welcome on stage. Yeah. I'm going to do a quick introduction. Nathan hat mir erzählt, dass er als Teenager in den USA, wo er aufgewachsen ist, eigentlich so ein klassischer Nerd war. Also anstatt Freitag und Samstag in den Ausgang zu gehen, saß er vor dem Computer und hat programmiert. Es lag also relativ nah, dass er dann Computerwissenschaft und angewandte Mathematik studiert hat. Und während seines Bachelors noch in den USA hat er sich dann begonnen zu interessieren für künstliche Intelligenz. Und um das zu durchdringen, das hat er dann bald gemerkt, reicht es nicht nur, Computerprogramme zu verstehen, zu lernen und denen das Verstehen beizubringen, sondern man muss eben auch das menschliche Gehirn verstehen lernen. Und deswegen ist er dann zu einem Doktorat nach Lausanne an die EPFL und hat da Neurowissenschaft studiert. Und er hat dann an der Fondation Agalma in Genf geforscht zu psychologischen und neurophysiologischen Vorgängen bei spontaner Kreativität. Und Sie sehen schon, um Kreativität dreht sich eben auch seine Präsentation. Und was ihn für diesen Vortrag hier zur Einführung prädestiniert, ist, dass Nathan eben auch Musiker ist, DJ und Produzent. Also er kennt nicht nur die Theorie, sondern auch die Praxis. Welcome, Nathan.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Er wird natürlich dann auch mit am Panel sein, so good presentation and okay. See you later.
Thank you. Thank you. Hello, everyone. Thank you for being here so numerously. It's really a pleasure for me to be here because I think that this topic is something that's very interesting for everyone from all sorts of different backgrounds. And what I'd like to do today is try to establish a little bit of a background and a little bit of the history and touch upon some of the neuroscience behind creativity just to give us a foundation upon which to discuss afterward. We're going to begin by doing a simple Turing test or an exercise where we just listen together to two different compositions, one on the left and one on the right, and we'll just listen to a tiny bit together. And I want you to be, meanwhile, thinking whether it's a machine that's generated the sound or whether it is a human who's generated it. And I've tried to match them for style in order to... Yeah, I won't say too much. I won't give you any hints. So we'll listen to the first one. For brevity's sake, I'm going to move to the next one. With that information, I would like just a show of hands. Who thinks that the first one, the one on the left, was made by a human? Okay. And who thinks that the one on the right, that we heard second, was made by a human? Sorry. No, I'm saying human in both cases, so anyway. There was no unanimity here. We didn't agree. Like, if I look around, there was no 100% of everyone said it's definitely the case on the left or on the right. But I have to say that as a majority, you got it correct. So the answer here is that the left one was made by a program called Deep Bach, and the right one was made by Real Bach. And those of you that are celebrating getting it right, I would also challenge you to do this over a number of times, and you'll probably notice that at some point you end up getting it wrong. And what happened in the room is that a certain percentage of people also did get it wrong, and that is kind of, I think, why we're here today, because we're arriving at this point where artificial composition and creation is starting to create examples that are becoming indistinguishable from human creation. And that starts to, in some sense, shake the foundations of what we think creativity and art is, and especially if you're somebody who believes that art is an endeavor that can only be achieved by humans or that requires a special human touch. And I think this is why we're here today. But I also want to mention that it's not really a new question. So about 20 years ago in 1997, there was this same type of test that I just gave you a minute ago, a Turing test, where a pianist played three different compositions. The first of which was a piece by Bach. A second was by a university professor who studies Bach, but created in the style of Bach. And the third was by a machine that already existed 20 years ago in order to create, that was called Emmy at the point. And actually, the crowd pretty much unanimously decided that in that case, the machine was really Bach and that the professor was the machine. And in that case, that already became a little bit discomforting for people 20 years ago, but now we're 20 years farther and the methods have changed substantially. And the number of people, the complexity of the compositions that are coming out are becoming more and more difficult to distinguish from what humans are doing. But kind of what I'd like to do today is touch a little bit on what are the methods that are being used in artificial intelligence in order to create these compositions, and simultaneously, what are the methods that are done in the human brain for human creation. And then we'll kind of look at them and say, okay, are they actually comparable, and what is it that shakes our foundations and makes us uncomfortable here? So to begin with the artificial intelligence and computational simulation, again, the idea is nothing new. In 1792, Mozart's publisher actually created something called the Musikalische Würfenspiel. You have to forgive my German. But the idea behind this is that you would take a pair of die and you roll the die, and the number on the die tells you which card to take in the sequence of a small series of small components of composition. So of course somebody composed little atoms of composition, but they were randomly drawing which atom to take next. And basically by rolling the dice multiple times, you would assemble a long composition which was composed of a number of smaller choices that were randomly chosen through an algorithmic, or in this case, through dice. And this idea was just a way of thinking about how to create automatically probabilistic music. And now if we flash forward to today, there's all this hype around something called deep learning and neural networks, and you have all sorts of very interesting research projects by these massive technology companies such as Google and IBM going into creating these research or these artificial intelligent beasts that can soak up and absorb huge corpuses of data and then spit out original compositions. And so that's kind of where we've come in so far. But these are somehow algorithmic compositions that are based on rule-driven sets, and also are data-driven. And so they learn on previous examples and then learn to create something new given what they've seen. The second type of artificial intelligence that's currently being used is something called creative augmentation, or what I call creative augmentation, which is basically that as a human is composing, there's a piece of software that's suggesting to them what they could do. So proposing to them new directions for their composition to go, suggesting new chord progressions, or perhaps different instrumentation to use. And this type of artificial intelligence, I think, is not what we're here to talk about today, because nobody really would argue that this is going to replace humans in creating. It's more of a symbiosis, or a collaborative work between humans and machines. And so I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what we know about human creativity in order to compare this against the way in which we currently model creativity in machines. And the first most general way of looking at the human creative process is that it's composed of about two steps. The first is something called generation, where we end up trying to create as many ideas as possible. We kind of vomit out ideas and play around with reformulating previous ideas that we've had, and we create this bed of possibility. And we look for that to be somehow original. And the second stage of that is refinement or selection. So it's choosing which ideas are societally relevant, which ones seem to be original, which ones have that feeling of something that feels worth going deeper into. So this generation and selection are actually two stages in the creative process that have neural analogs. And so if we look into the brain, basically these are both supported by something called neuroplasticity. And neuroplasticity is the ability of the brain to forge new neural connections, to create new connections between the neurons, and also to favor the connections which seem the most relevant. So in this case, there are three neural processes called synaptogenesis, myelination, and synaptic pruning that that together form neuroplasticity. And synaptogenesis is nothing more than the creation of extra connections between neurons. So it's the ability of our brain to create new connections with other neurons or to change itself in that direction. Just to skip over to synaptic pruning, that's basically the opposite. It's the ability of our brain to forget the connections that we no longer think are important and to favor the ones which we end up using more regularly. And finally, myelination is the ability for the brain to favor connections between individual neurons by putting this little sheath around what's called the axon that connects the two neurons. And this sheath helps insulate the connection between the two so that information is spread faster from one neuron to the other. And so the brain has these mechanisms behind it that end up favoring these two processes that I mentioned, the generative process. So in the synaptogenesis, we're generating ideas, we create new neurons and new ways of looking at things. And this selection process, so synaptic pruning and myelination end up favoring previous neural networks that are already existing. But this is at the individual neural level. And if we look at a systems level or at the brain as a whole, so like what you're used to seeing of these brain dialogues, we can talk at a systems level as well. And this network called the default mode network is a collection of brain regions that speak between one another. And in this case, since it's not really an anatomy course, I'm not going to mention where we're looking at here in the brain, but there are several different regions which fire together in synchrony. And these tend to happen when our mind is wandering and when we're not paying attention to things. So hopefully right now you're not in the default mode network. And in that case, we can kind of shortcut and call this the imagination network. And it's what's happening when we end up thinking differently, when we take perspectives, and when we introspect. Likewise, another important brain network that's involved in the creative process is the salience network, which is one that helps us select the ideas and attend to the ideas that are of importance. And because without our focal, we have a certain amount of ability to focus on what's actually happening, and our brain has to choose what's important to focus on at the very moment. And so the salience network focuses on this. And something called the executive control network, which again is a set of brain regions which work in concert together across a lot of the brain, in fact. It's not just in one individual spot. That's why these are all called networks. The executive control network helps us is activated whenever we're planning and setting goals and working in a particular direction. And so these different networks are always in a concert where they're dancing between one another during the creative process. There's no like creative place in the brain where we create and then that small region activates or something like that. This is a set of very complex set of different networks which are always in a complex ballet between one another, activating and suppressing themselves. And so if we come back to those two processes in the creative process, the generation and selection process, and we kind of take this new information that you have about the brain, during generation, there's the activation of the imagination network, and our executive control network tends to be suppressed. So we're not like really planning or setting goals, we're just letting our mind wander during the generation phase. And during the selection phase, at that point, our imagination network is being suppressed and the executive control and salience networks start to kick in and help us make something of those ideas that we've just created out of the blue. So, if we come back and try to compare how similar artificial creation is to human creation, I guess the easiest way for me to compare them is not to go through all the different algorithms and say how they're trying to model these brain processes, but rather to say, on the whole, what are current models of artificial intelligence lacking or unable to account for that our brain does. And so I had a few ideas around this, and the first is this so-called black box approach, which is one that the neural networks take, where they just listen to like an entire corpus of Bach data, and once they listen to the Bach data, they're able to create a new Bach-like sound, it actually doesn't try to model human creative cognition at all. All they know is that the information comes in, the computer finds some sort of pattern in this complex data, and then it spits out something. And so this is a kind of mystery what's happening on the inside, and it's not explicit whatsoever or trying to even model after the way that the human brain is creating or based on what we know about human creation and our brain. So actually the most common models in artificial intelligence right now aren't even really trying to mimic the human brain in terms of human creation. They're not trying to create by as if the brain does. They're using a sort of alternate path of creation. And they don't have any notion of emotion or motivation. So if I'm creating a piece and I'm trying to get into that piece and it touches me in some certain way, that emotional state that I have might end up driving some of my decisions, and that is something that's completely unaccounted for in current models. Likewise, they have no ability to evaluate their own ideas or select which ideas are important. So that whole second phase of the creative process that I was saying, where they select the ideas that they create, is completely forgotten, actually. And so in this case, all that the computer models are doing right now is spitting out lots of novel ideas. But once those novel ideas are there, it's up to humans to come in and tell you which ones are important and which ones are actually of relevance for our society or for the targeted audience or this type of thing. And finally, it also ignores entirely the idea of collaboration or interaction or surprises from the outside. So these models are creating things in a vacuum in some sense. They take information in and they are creating by themselves. There's no other, they're not collaborating with other computers to create music. They're not being surprised or challenged on their own models. They're creating in their own cave, which, by the way, some humans can also do. So that doesn't maybe make it all too different. And finally, that by nature, they're derivative. So what they are doing is trying to find patterns in the data that they're capturing and then to create something new based on the patterns that they found in that data. So they're good at maybe creating, like we saw, a Bach chorale-like piece, but they're not going to have their own signature or try to challenge what Bach chorale is and create a new genre of music. They can only go as far as the genre that they've learned tells them. And then the moment you could think, well, what if we feed them all music from all of humanity since the beginning of time? I have a personal opinion that at that point, it wouldn't be able to find the patterns sufficient to actually generate new meaningful pieces. And of course, I will probably run over time if I go too much farther, so I'm going to skip ahead a little bit just to one last point, which is that AI creation, and I brought this up at the beginning, that it somehow feels intuitively wrong. Like a lot of us are a little bit uneasy about machines creating. And I sort of have this impression that we all agree that if there's a set of instructions to follow and then we create based on that set of instructions, that somehow that's less creative than something that writes its own instructions and creates, can break its own rules. And at the moment, a lot of the AI models don't actually do that. Of course, there's like a lot of room for probability. We don't know exactly what it's going to do or how it's going to model it. But the fact is, it's still written by code that's immutable, and it doesn't go and re-edit its own code. And somehow, I think the creative process in humans is like taking rules and being able to break your own rules and relearn in some sort of new way. So creating these new neural connections is somehow different than a brain, than a simulation of a brain, which has to follow the same capacitors each time. And we have this very romantic view of creativity, which is that it's somehow the purest expression of the human spirit, and that it's almost a spiritual or a mystical type type process. And I think that the idea of machines making something that can touch humans in the same way of humans touching humans is a little bit unnerving based on this romantic view that we have of this holy creative process. So just to end before the panel, I wanted to give one other little thought experiment, and this time it's in visual art, so we're going to move to paintings, because of course, I'll remind you that today we're here to talk about music composition and artificial intelligence, but of course, these models are being used everywhere to create art in all types of forms. And here there are six different paintings, which I'll have you just, this time we'll, since there are six, it'll be easier if you just think in your head to yourself, which of these were created by a machine and which were created by a human? Okay, and hopefully you have it in your head. So drum roll, we'll move here. And the final answer is actually I cheated because the reality is that none are made by a machine. And what is really going on here is that the first five are made by different animals. So a chimpanzee, elephant, orangutan, and gorilla. And only the sixth one is made by a human. And so I raise this point because actually I think it's also worth asking ourselves at what point, if we just forget about machines altogether, where do we draw the line with creativity? Do we allow that animals can be creative? Do we allow that infants can be creative? Do we allow that mentally challenged people can be creative? Like, why is it such an innate human thing, and what do we allow? And so with that, I want to welcome this discussion, and thank you for your attention.